Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and you're listening to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. Today we're joined, Dave Morris and I are joined by Cyan, who's listening, but mostly we're here to interview Ed Finkler. Ed, did I get that right?
Yep, Finkler, yep.
So you're a PHP programmer and a famous podcaster. Can you tell us about the podcast that you're running?
I don't know if I'm famous podcaster, but... I do a podcast with a friend of mine, Chris Hartjes, who lives in Toronto, and I live in Indiana in the U.S. We do a podcast called Development Hell, which is really just a kind of a informal conversation of two old web developers who are very cranky and grumpy about things. So... So we've been doing that. I think we're up to episode, I have to count. We're into the 30s now, like 35 or something like that, I think. So we've been doing it for about a year and a half. And both of us come from PHP circles because that's just how we know each other. We've both been doing a lot of did PHP for a very long time. So that's kind of our background. It has been as PHP developers. I've more lately been doing web development with Python, and I've been doing a lot of JavaScript for a few years now. So Chris is still doing lots of PHP, sometimes to his chagrin. So we just kind of have as kind of informal, try to kind of keep it light and funny, and just babble about stuff we're interested in, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well. Actually, we're not here to talk about the show per se, but I did download it and have a listen to a few of the episodes, and they're quite good. And as I beat my head against the wall on a PHP upload script, I'm resisting the urge to troubleshoot it online here with you now.
But
during one of those episodes, you did a kind of special, and then it's through that at think that Dave brought it to our attention here in the HBR community news last month, so I thought, well, let's get you on to interview about that. Can you tell us what it was that happened?
So it was episode 15. So it was a little over a year ago. And so the background is that I've been going for many years to a PHP conference called PHP Tech, which has taken place for many years in Chicago in the summer, in May, I think it is. And I hope I'm right about that. So it was May 2012. I went up and I gave a couple talks. I've spoken at PHP Tech for a few years now, just about different things. This one was through no fault of the conference. This one was a really tough one to handle for me personally. I had a few things kind of came together that made my experience really poor. I have to use a thing called a CPAP because I have a condition called sleep apnea. Which basically means that, so if you're familiar with sleep apnea, basically you stop breathing while you're asleep, which is kind of not cool. So you use probably the most common treatment is use a thing called a CPAP, which is, it basically uses air pressure to shunt open your throat so that you can actually breathe, which is kind of important. I drove up to Chicago. I only live a couple hours away, but I had forgotten my CPAP, which is sign of unfortunate. So I had a lot of trouble sleeping. I also forgot, I take a few different medications and I forgot a couple of them. And it was, so that was just a disaster of planning all around on my part. So I was just in a really bad place. I forgot my medication. A lot of times, even if you don't, it isn't necessarily like with some medications, it's not like you have a, sometimes if you haven't, if you don't, if you just stop taking them, even after a half a day or something like that, it varies. But some things, if you don't take them, your body's used to them, and I'll have some issues, like I might get a little bit of vertigo or something like that. The combination is I also got sick too, which probably is because I wasn't sleeping. And I got pretty sick, and that whole combo really, really was bad. And the medications that I take for anxiety and depression. So not having those and not feeling well because I didn't have the medication, which kind of messed me up a little bit, and also just not getting the help that they give me with those kinds of issues, and being sick and not sleeping well, that was a really, really bad combination. And I had, it was a real struggle for me. There were definitely parts of me that wanted to go home, and just skip my talks and go home and, bail out of the whole thing. I think I ended up going home kind of early anyway, but the whole thing was pretty unpleasant. I was upset and very down about the whole, the whole thing. And again, the conference was a good conference. It had nothing to do with that. It was just my personal experience dealing with some stuff. And I guess going through that and going through, and it's something that this was one of the harder experiences I've had, but I have this experience a fair bit when I go to conferences. There's always sort of a time where I get kind of dark and down, and I wish I was home, and I just don't like being there because it's in a weird place and I don't really know a lot of people a lot of times and things like that. Which isn't super helpful if you're a person who speaks at a few conferences. I don't talk at a lot of them, but I usually talk at 2 or 3 a year. So thinking about that, this it sort of came to a head a little bit. Me thinking about this, and I thought about what I had kind of been through here, and what it, I was thinking about it, thinking about what I was learning about, myself and what I was dealing with, and in the context of being a developer and being a member of an open source community and things like that. And I decided that I wanted to talk about the things that I've struggled with. Regarding my mental health, I wanted to talk about it on the podcast, and so I talked about it with Chris, my co-host, and he said, "Well, okay, that doesn't sound very funny, but I guess we could do that." He was, I think he was unsure because he was kind of like, "Well, this isn't what we usually talk about," and it, but man, if you want to talk about it, that's okay, right? He was supportive of it.
Fair enough, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so he kind of let me just ramble on on the podcast for like an hour about my struggles with my mental health. In terms of for me primarily it's been anxiety and depression, and I have adult ADD, attention deficit disorder. And all three of those things have just been, things that I've had to deal with in terms of my mental health. And so I talked about it, and it was kind of scary because I talked somewhat freely about it on things like Twitter or stuff like that. But not I don't sit down and be like, "Hey, I'm going to tell everybody my life experience with this," like from when I was a kid and go on, and that's a tough thing. And it's a different thing to, I guess, to do it like on a podcast in front of a bunch of, not well that a bunch of people are going
Yeah,
to listen to and things like that, right?
I was just going to say that here you are now, waffling on, telling us the whole story. How is this different?
Yeah, well, it's old hat for me now, right? Because what's happened is that when I did that podcast and we released it, we got just a huge response. It was by far our most popular episode. The feedback we got was we got lots of feedback, and the feedback we kept hearing was really, it was kind of one of two things. It was either, "Thank you for sharing with this. More people need to talk about this. This is, something I don't know that I really understood what it was like until somebody sat down and was, you know, brave enough to explain about it or things like that. I don't know how brave I am. I just eventually, you know, I'm less and less embarrassed about my quirks as I get older. But so there's that. But then the other feedback we got was from lots of people saying, no one else has ever talked about this so openly that I've heard, and I have the exact same problems, or I have similar problems, and nobody knows about it, or only a very, very few people know about it. And I've been struggling with this for a long time, basically in silence. And thank you so much for talking about it. You know, I had tons of people reaching out to me with those same kinds of stories.
I think, just to cut you off there, I don't know, I wouldn't class myself as that, but I do have the traditional like pre-conference phone call with my wife going, what am I doing here?
Uh-huh.
Why should I be here? And you know, trying to force yourself in.
Yep.
I think a lot of us can relate to that in certain respects.
Yeah, it's a conference can be a pretty intimidating thing, and it can be hard if you are, especially if you go to a conference and you don't have like a, it's gotten easier for me to go to a lot of PHP conferences because I see a lot of the same people and you have the same friends there and stuff like that. The conferences that are particularly hard for me are when I'm in a new city and I don't really know anybody, and there's times where it's just like, I just want to go back to my own bed and lay down and not be here anymore. You know, some people are very outgoing and get excited about exploring new things and aren't intimidated by those things or aren't kind of scared by those things. And I find being in places where I don't sort of feel like I know the rules or I don't feel like at home here or things like that, I find that really intimidating and I find that kind of scary. And so that's a thing that I struggle with a lot, particularly if you're related to conferences. I think those things can be intimidating, let alone I think a lot of people feel like, well, there's all these smart people here and I'm not that smart, and they have deal with a thing like a thing that you might call imposter syndrome. A lot of people talk about that, and so I had a lot of that feedback, right? And it's really good feedback that I felt like I'd sort of touched on something that a lot of people wanted to hear more about and talk more about, but people hadn't been doing that. And so I thought for quite a while about like what to do with this information. Like I feel like I kind of struck a nerve, right? And I didn't know exactly what I should do. And I thought about, well, maybe I could build something I'm good at building web stuff. So maybe I could build something like that or try to start a community. I don't know. I all of them didn't quite seem like they resonated with me, at least. I sort of struggled with ideas for what to do. And I kind of came to the conclusion after a few months that I think the good idea would be to just keep talking. And just keep talking about stuff. And so at the beginning of this year, I wrote up a proposal that I was going to start giving to, and proposed at a few different conferences, that was me just talking about my experiences with my mental health experiences and my experiences with anxiety and depression in the context of who I am, which is a developer and open source community member, and also, you know, family member and things like that. Somebody who works in IT.
Yeah.
Right. And so in doing that, I proposed it a couple places I knew I was going to go. And then I started thinking a little bit more about it. And I am not the kind of person who typically likes to, ask for money. I've not done that before. Not really a big fan of that. It's not like it's bad for other people. That's sort of not my style. I'm not really super comfortable with it. But I started thinking, well, what if, if I had a little bit more money, I wonder if I could speak at more conferences. Like there was some, like I was thinking about the O'Reilly Open Source Conference, which is a place that I would like to propose it, but that's an expensive endeavor. There's, you know, they don't cover anything for speakers. So it's, they give you a ticket, but they don't cover any hotel or airfare or anything like that. And so that would, you're talking about $1,500 to $2,000 just, being within the US just to go there, right? just for that side of things.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's quite a bit of money. And so I said, okay, I asked people on Twitter and I was like, hey, what do you think I should do? Do you think it would be bad to ask for this? And people were like, you should totally do this. So I said, okay. And I did, I looked at a couple things and I decided that Indiegogo, that website was a little bit of a better match. Because with Kickstarter, I looked at Kickstarter and they sort of want you to have a product at the end of it. So I wasn't sure 100% that I had a very well formulated product at the end of the thing. And then the second thing was that Indiegogo had a setup where you could, if you're not fully funded, you can keep the money you've gotten under certain circumstances. So, and I was like, well, I don't know how much money I'm going to get. And so we'll just figure it out from there. So
yeah, anything's better than nothing, basically.
Yeah, right. That's the idea. So I figured in my case, if it even finally got like a couple hundred dollars, that was still better than, you know, $0. So that seemed like a good match for me. But both of those seemed, I decided to do it on a website like that, as opposed to just doing it like, I don't know, put up a PayPal link or something, or some other system of payments, because I was nervous about, I felt like it was easier to, it would be easier to market it if I went to one of those sorts of things, like people understand how they work and they, for one reason or another, seem less shady and things like that. I don't, you know, it just, I felt like that was a little bit, that would give me a little bit of advantage in fundraising. So I set a goal for $3,000, which would allow me to go to OzCon and probably a couple other things. And I had some things planned out and, said, hey, these are the things I'm proposing at, and listed out, and this is what I want to do, blah, 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 blah. And within very quickly, I think we broke the goal like it been the first day, which was really awesome. And then, so we got almost two times what the goal was, so nearly $6,000. I think it was like $55 or $5,600. And so that was really amazing. And just the way that people stepped up, and it felt like that was sort of a, you know, an indicator that, yeah, this is something that a lot of people care about and are concerned about and want to hear people talking about more. And so I got that money. And so I was able to propose at some other places. And so the short version is that this summer, then, I've been speaking at different conferences. Like I spoke at PHP Tech this year as an unconference session. That was the first time I'd done the talk. I spoke at Open Source Bridge, which is a conference in Portland in June, in Portland, Oregon. And then I spoke at Lone Star PHP in Dallas. And then let's see, where else there? Oh, the O'Reilly Open Source Conference. I was at OzCon in July. And then I'm going to speak at Madison Ruby, which is in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm going to do that next weekend. I'm going to speak there. And it feels like I'm forgetting one, so let me look this up. But the point is that those are the places that – and then Distill, which is a conference at Engine Yard, has put on. I just last week went to San Francisco and spoke at that. So that's the other one. I went and was able to speak there, and that's really cool. It's gone very well. I've been able to. The first one I only had audio of, but all the other ones I've been able to videotape. Well, not tape, record. Well enough to still call
old
it taping.
School, man. Old school.
Yeah, I know. I still say, can you tape that for me? And so I've been able to videotape, I said it again, record on my phone all the talks, and they turned out decently, at least, that you can hear and see what I say, and you can and see me talking, and then you can see, get the slides, and you can mostly follow along. So yeah, that's the plan right now. So I'm going to speak at Madison Ruby next weekend. And then after that, I'm going to take a well-deserved break, because I'm very tired and been speaking a lot like the past 2 months. And then September, I don't have anything. October, I may be speaking or doing something related to Brooklyn Beta, which is a conference that my company Fictive Kin puts on. And then in November, I'm going to go to True North PHP, which is a PHP conference that's co-organized by my podcast co-host, Chris Hartress. So he has to let me speak. That's part of the rules. So that's like that for this year. The feedback I've gotten has been really good. People seem to enjoy and relate relate to the talk or find it eye opening. So everything has really gone very well with it. And one of the kind of cool things is that, since the beginning, I've kind of been talking with the guys at Engine Yard, particularly with Eamon Leonard, who contacted me, and I've been talking with him and a couple other guys who've been talking about the mental health issues within the tech community. And they at Distill, at the end of Distill, they launched a new campaign called Prompt. So it's at prompt.engineyard.com, prompt.engineyard.com. And basically the idea is to do more and have Engine Yard and hopefully other organizations do more to help raise awareness and keep this discussion going. So they highlight works of Greggy B, Greg Bouges, I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong, he'll hate me, and also John Dalton, who's another guy, and he actually works for Engine Yard, but he's been speaking about this stuff too. Basically they give you opportunities to kind of like get involved and support what we're doing, and also get in contact if you want a speaker to come to a conference. That's basically the idea with Prompt. So we're kind of taking that's sort of a step where an organization that has a little bit more financial resources can help keep this going. And I think that's pretty cool. So I'm excited about like what NGR wants to do with Prompt. And I'm hoping that other organizations will get involved too, so we can kind of keep that going and get people talking about this stuff. So it's been exciting. It's been a little hard because I get kind of nervous traveling a lot. I get real nervous about things like planning stuff out and worrying that I'm going to forget something. And it's particularly with flying, I get really nervous about that. And, you know, I have a few things I have to take with me. Like I have to take my CPAP and I have to take my medication. If I don't have those things, I get real nervous and I get kind of nervous about going to places I haven't been before and stuff like that. But, all in all, it's really worked out well. The responses have been really good. Things have been going well. And I think we're doing some good stuff in terms of helping people feel freer to talk about these things. That's the key for me really, is to do that. And so that's been really helpful to hear people, acknowledge that really is helping. So that's kind of where we're at right now, like with the campaign. I think it's gone really well so far.
I have a few questions, obviously.
Absolutely.
Your employer, first of all, you're a family man.
I am.
And how has your family taken to you being away so often?
Well, that's a good question. I don't like to travel a whole ton, and one of the reasons is that I don't like to put that burden on my family where I'm gone. But the nice thing, the great thing is that I have a wife and a son, and my wife has just been incredibly supportive of it. I had to talk to her and say, look, this is going to involve me being, a couple of these months, I might be gone for, I've gone off to two conferences in a month. And that means that I might only be here, like half the month. Right. I need you to be okay with that, because if you're not, I can't do this, right? I can't leave her and just say this is something that, to take care of our son on her own. My son's getting a little older, so it's a little bit easier, but she has been incredibly supportive and said this is an important thing, and I think that you're supposed to be doing this, so it's okay, take the time. And it's not always easy. You know, and sometimes she's like, this is, you know, it's been a little bit tough, but she's just been incredibly supportive. And really, it, you know, without her, I wouldn't be able to do this. And without the support of her, that I mean, not just practically, but emotionally, I wouldn't be able to do this. And so she's been just incredible about it. And that certainly has been key in making this happen. I wouldn't even be out here if it wasn't for her. So it's been really good.
And your employer, do you get time off there, or is it just on the weekends?
So no, I actually have to take time away. And they've been really
Well,
good. They've been really good about it. I'm a partner at a company, Fictive Kin, and it's not a huge company, and we try to not keep it too crazy, you know, startup-y. You know, we don't do things like work 70-hour weeks or stupid stuff like that. But you know, I of course had to talk with them and say, hey, this is something I think I want to do. And here's like the initial schedule I'm looking at. These are these conferences. And I, you know, is this going to be okay? You know, typically I think if it was just the thing where it's like, I'm just going to a bunch of conferences and I'm gonna, you know, I don't know, even if it was like, I'm gonna go talk about, you know, how to build websites. You know, that's not as interesting or as compelling or probably as something that they would be like totally okay with. But given the topic and you know, this is a little bit of a different kind of deal, work has been incredibly supportive. So the guys at Fictive Kin have been, you know, my partners there have been very, very good in supporting what I do. I try to, you know, as much as I can, take days to work. So when I'm not speaking, you know, I try to put time in on work. But it's hard, you know, you have it. You know, you have to take it days to travel, and you have to. I can't really work very well in days I have to speak because I have to think about my talk and stuff like that. So, it certainly interrupts how much, you know, I'm around and has it interrupted how much I've been around this summer. So, it's, I think they're glad that it's calming down some and September is going to be free completely and things like that. So, but they've been just incredibly supportive. So, I certainly could not do that without work, you know, my workplace being that supportive of it either. That wouldn't have happened.
How long do you intend to continue doing this?
Well, it's a good question. You know, my idea was that the money we were talking about, the fundraising we did at part of that, the Indiegogo campaign would be something that I would talk about or that would probably, you know, do this year. So it would get me to a few conferences this year. My suspicion is that there will be, I'll keep talking about it into next year, although I'm not going to, I don't think my intention is not to plan anything more for this year because I want to kind of take it a little bit easy. Not get super burned out on it. The great thing is that one of the great things about Prompt, the Engine Yard campaign, is that some other people that they've identified can, you know, are able to speak about these kinds of things too. And they can, you know, maybe if I need to take a little downtime, you know, they maybe have an opportunity to get some other folks that maybe want to speak if people want them at a conference. And so that's really good. But I expect that I will continue talking about this into next year at least. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to plan out too much ahead of time, but I expect that I'll keep talking about this because I think that there's more people to reach. I think there's more discussion to be had. You know, to keep working at this you know, get the conversation, keep that conversation going. And I guess the idea really is to make it so it's not so stigmatized. A lot of people are really afraid to talk about their mental health issues and or you know, don't know how to bring them up or understand sort of what's going on with folks who do have issues, who do have struggles with it. And that's something that I think is a big part of the problem, is that our fear of discussing it, I think leads to people not getting treated and people having serious physical and you know problems because of that. One of the interesting things I've been reading about is just about how anxiety and depression, how they can physically affect your well-being. So it's not simply just a matter of mentally you're sort of not there, but physically it's okay and everything like that. No, it's actually there's a pretty strong correlation between those things and your mortality rate, and essentially you die sooner if you have if you struggle with those kinds of things. And that is not entirely just, say, a consideration from, say, something like suicide rates or something like that. No, it actually compromises your health and makes it more likely for you to be affected by health issues, by, you know, things that are acknowledged as just purely physical health issues or things like that. So, that, you know, people don't get treated for this kind of stuff because they're scared, and because culturally we're afraid to talk about this stuff, and too oftentimes it gets treated as if it's a matter of, well, you just need to calm down, or you just need to deal with it, and that it's something like that, where it's something like you're just scared or you're just not tough enough, and that's just not true. It's a real, you know, depression, for example, is a real physical condition where your body is actually going through a severe stress response, but it's doing it at a completely inappropriate time, or like constantly going through one. That dramatically impacts your physical well-being. So there are enormous biological elements to it, and perhaps entirely biological. And it's just that we don't really know how the brain works very well. But there's a really good talk that I reference a lot by a guy named Robert Sapolsky. And I link to it if you go to Funkatron.
I'll put a link in the show notes. Don't worry about
that. Yeah. Funkatron.com/OSMI, open source mental illness, open sourcing mental illness, excuse me. So if you go to Funkatron.com/OSMI, it has this talk on the link from there, Robert Sapolsky, on depression. And so Sapolsky is a biologist and neurologist at Stanford University, and he talks about the nature of depression, the biology of it, and also the psychology of it. But essentially, he posits that depression is the most damaging disease that you can experience. It's hugely disabling for people on a true physical level. It is not just in your mind. It has a dramatic impact on your physical well-being, and is an enormous cause of disability in the U.S. and becoming more and more common. But we don't treat that the same way that we treat things like heart disease or lung cancer or diabetes. We have a very different relationship with mental health issues, because culturally there's a sort of a belief, I think, that people who have mental ill health issues, probably because we don't understand how the brain works, or our understanding has getting better, but is still not great. We still have this expectation as well. Really what they are, they're lazy, or they are, you know, just scared or tired, or just don't want to do things, or just overreacting. And while I do think that a person has to actively choose to get better and actively has to engage in their treatment, at the same time, I think it's entirely unhelpful to be completely unsympathetic to folks who suffer from this. And, you know, one of the worst things I hear from people is to say, it's no big deal, just calm down. Like, that, if I could just calm down, my life would not be a problem, right? None of this would be a problem if I could just calm down. I mean, believe me, I've been trying for almost 40 years, and it doesn't work that way. It is far more complex than that, and far more debilitating. But there are things that we can do, and there are treatments that we can work with. You know, these are not unsolvable problems, and these are not issues that can't be treated. I think the biggest problem is that instead of treating them, we're scared to talk about them. And as a consequence, people don't get the treatment they need. And so that's what I'm really hoping to do with this, is to get people feel like they can be more open about it, and therefore feel and remove that stigma and help each other, you know, deal with these kinds of things.
Okay. Ed, it sounds like one of your biggest triggers was being in places that you're unfamiliar with in front of large crowds. And I'm just curious, what's it like now as you go about speaking? Because you're putting yourself through all that stress that seemed to land you in the first place to depression.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually have gotten comfortable with speaking in front of people, and that's not as big a deal. And it's interesting how there are some things that trigger you, but they're not, it will be very specific. And it, of course, varies from person to person what can trigger somebody. I know some people who are super uncomfortable just talking on the phone with people, but if they speak in person, it's fine. You know, they don't have a problem with that. For me, speaking in front of people actually isn't a huge deal, although it can vary, and certainly it's not an unstressful situation, but I am comfortable with it, and I kind of deal with it, I think, in a good way, where I know how to get myself ready for it and take positive energy into it and stuff like that. And I think part of that is because I've become comfortable and familiar in that position and familiar with the experience of that. Things that I do have problems with are more likely to be issues where, here's a great example. I am often, like if I go to some place and I don't know how their public transportation system works, and I'm putting this in, you can't see, but I have little air quotes, how it works in the sense of, like, well, how much does everything cost, and where do these buses or trains go, or things like that, and where am I supposed to sit, and how do I give them the money, and do they take cash, or do they take credit, or whatever? I don't understand how any of this works, right? So putting myself in a situation like that, particularly when I know there's going to be, like, a group of people on the bus who probably know how to use it and are going to wonder why I'm, you know, like, or might be, I perceive as being annoyed because I don't really know what I'm doing, that will immediately put me in I will be very uncomfortable with that and will usually opt to avoid that situation entirely. Like, I've learned places where I'm comfortable, like, okay, I can get to the airport and I can usually figure out how to take a taxi. And if I know where to go, I just tell that taxi, take me here, and I'll be okay. Just take me to the hotel where I'm staying, and then I can figure out where the conference is, and then I go from hotel to conference, and I can, if I need to, if I'm tired or I need a nap or something, I can go back to the hotel, and I know my way around, stuff like that, then everything is probably going to be okay, right? I get, like, if I don't know what all those steps are, or they fall out of it, it's like, well, you can do this, but you're going to have to, you know, take some public transportation you've never heard of, and there's not going to be anybody with you. You can, but just figure it out yourself. That puts me in a really, really bad place where I'm very freaked out about, like, how I'm going to do that. And for a lot of people, that's not something they deal with, because it's like, it might make them a little nervous, but not really. But what I have is I have a really severe stress reaction to that situation.
Is that ADD?
I would chalk that up as to that I have a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder.
Okay.
And that would fall into that. So ADD really, has to do with, like, your ability to stay focused on tasks, and say, particularly doing tasks that you're not compelled to do at the time, like not very interested in. That's what I struggle with a lot regarding that. There's more to it than that. Somebody should certainly look up attention deficit disorder if they're interested in it. But for me, it's my anxiety, and that anxiety disorder that I have, that's where that's coming from, where I have anxiety in like severe anxiety about things that don't really warrant it. So it's not like something that should give you anxiety, like somebody pulls a gun on you, right? It's something like, I had another example. One time I was going to, some friends of mine were getting together at a bar downtown in the city I live in, in Lafayette, Indiana. And I was they invited me to come meet them. And it was a bar I hadn't been to before. And I didn't know like what it was like inside. And so all of that kind of freaked me out. And I got there and sort of walked in front of the place and decided that I just couldn't go in and was just going to go back to my car and leave. And then a friend of mine who was inside texted me and said, "Hey, we're all here in the back." And I was like, okay, that like pushed me enough to like get me in the door. But I was super, super nervous about it. And I was ready to just walk away because I was so uncomfortable with that feeling of going into a place that was new. And I didn't know sort of the etiquette and I didn't know like what it would be like. And it just put me in a really bad spot. And one of the things that I tend to do is I'll imagine like I'll form negative outcomes really quickly. I'll form these different negative outcomes. Like if I can't, if this happens, then I will follow a chain of events down to suddenly I end up like in a Turkish prison in jail for the rest of my life. And it started off with like, I got the wrong kind of bread. I can have sort of that. I can just form those kinds of things really fast in my head. And that can be kind of problematic when they're particularly negative and you tend to kind of focus on like, well, this is really going to happen. And it's not. And I know that I'm conscious of the fact that it's not logical, but I'm still having severe anxiety about it. And that's what's, I think, most frustrating about it is that I know damn well that it's not logical. But the problem is that I feel like I'm not in control of what my body's responses are to it, my emotional and physical responses are to the situation. And that's very challenging. And that's one of the reasons I take medication, is because that helps me deal with those things and reduces that level of anxiety and problems to some extent. So for me, that helps a lot.
Ed, can I ask you how this, the campaign and the talks you've done and so forth have affected you? Have you found that in some ways it's acted as therapy for you?
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely, there's a couple things that have happened. One, I think it helps me when I get to talk about the stuff. And I think that that's a helpful thing because each time I talk about it, it sort of makes me think a little bit. It makes me rethink, you know, over that and wonder, you know, okay, well, what's some things that maybe I could do differently about that? Or how am I, it's kind of helping me stay actively engaged in treating it. And I think that's kind of a key thing for people, is that people who do suffer from this, sometimes there's a tendency to just sort of go to their general practitioner doctor and get a medication, and that's sort of the extent of which they engage in their treatment. And that helps for some people, and that works for some people, but there's a lot of people where it's an ongoing thing where they're going to need to kind of constantly be evaluating where they are, speaking with a therapist about things, and then maybe additionally taking medication too and stuff like that. This is a good way for me to kind of keep engaged with these things and kind of keep on top of them. It's certainly been the case that it's pushed me to, you know, to sort of think about things in new ways. And I've introduced new things into the talk since when I started, based on things that where it compelled me to kind of go up and research stuff, or I learned about things from the people shared with me or other people who are speaking about this stuff. And so those things have been really helpful for me. I think that, you know, and it's at a base level, if the fact that I keep getting good feedback on this and people keep coming up and talking to me about their own experiences, that makes it really, really, that's just a very satisfying thing. I feel like the thing that I like most about open source culture is the idea of shared learning And building things. And for me, I really, really enjoy that aspect of sharing what I've learned and trying to help people that way. And so I really enjoy that when I can, if I help them, you know, understand a technical thing or learn how to build a new kind of thing or just get a better understanding of some kind of issue like that. And for this is just particularly compelling because a lot of people seem to be getting something out of it. And that helps me. It helps me feel better. And I think the other aspect of it is it's made me sometimes challenge some of my anxiety when I said, you know what, this is something I need to do. And if I didn't have this sort of compelling me, I might be more likely to just kind of back off and not do this or not sort of challenge myself a little bit in terms of going out of my comfort zone a little bit, maybe in terms of travel or things like that. And I've done a little bit more of that. And that's been because I've done this. And I think that's been helpful for me.
In Britain, if you go and see your general practitioner and talk about depression, they often, and of course this is an experience I've had myself, I should say, you're offered the possibility of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy,
mm-hmm.
And that tries to get you to sort of almost hack your own brain to the extent that you are asked to look at the way that you respond to things and change the way you do it. Have you had that experience at all? Is that something you're offered at all in the States?
A lot of people have had very good success with CBT,
mm-hmm.
Particularly people who deal with anxiety. I have not pursued cognitive behavior therapy yet, but in fact, based on when I've kept hearing about it, as I've been talking with people, I'm actually intend to pursue that. Right now I just see a psychiatrist who kind of checks up on my meds every few months and stuff like that. But my intent is actually to contact her office and say, hey, I would like to look at cognitive behavior therapy and can you recommend somebody? Because a lot of people have had very good success with a lot of people who had generalized anxiety disorder or other anxiety related issues have had very good luck with it. That's been a treatment that people have had a lot of success with. So I'm interested in doing it, but I don't have any experience with it myself yet. So hopefully, like, you know, in a few months, maybe I will have some experience to try to deal with that. Because it sounds interesting, and anything that says that they've had that much success with, that is compelling to me. To try to do that and try to reduce my symptoms. So absolutely.
Yeah, it's the sort of it was put to me as here's a potential toolkit that you can use to modify your own behavior. You know, that seemed to be a very positive way of approaching the problem.
Exactly. I think it varies for different people. One of the things that I try really hard not to do, and I encourage other people not to do, is something they call cure evangelism, in which if you've had success with a particular therapy type, the cure evangelism would be tell everybody you know who suffers from a similar condition, oh, well, you should do this because I've had luck with that, you know, or you know, this is going to solve your problems. And the fact is that it seems to vary dramatically. Some people have just have different experiences with it. Different medications, people have different reactions to. Different kinds of therapy, people have different, you know, experiences with. There's a lot of variables that we don't understand well. So it's often very difficult to say this will obviously solve anybody who has, say, generalized anxiety disorder. And so CBT is something I'm interested in because it seems like a lot of people have had luck with it. One of the things I understand kind of going in, though, is that does not guarantee that I will have luck with it. And so that's one of the things that I try to keep in mind with everything. And that's why I kind of talk about with being engaged in your treatment is you really need to kind of constantly be evaluating how are things going and you know, thinking about that stuff. My experience has been that, and I think a lot of people's is like this, that they often have to try a few different kinds of medications you know, if they do take medications, and they may have to kind of strike on a combination that works well for them. And at the same time, they also may have to modify their medication over the course of years. And that's not uncommon. So it's, you know, that just happens, right? And so as long as you're, as long as you kind of keep that in mind, I think that you can kind of keep a little bit more of a positive attitude about that, but also, you know, kind of realistic that, so CBT seems like it helps a lot of people, but it's not, there is no panacea of solutions for folks either. So yeah, but it does look like there's some helpful things there. And for some folks, it seems to be very effective. So mm-hmm. I think that's very mm-hmm. encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I was looking at some of your YouTube talks earlier on today. I enjoyed them very much, by the way. They're very good. The bit I missed was the Q&A. Obviously, you didn't have there was no chance to do that in the session. I just wondered what sort of feedback you got from people. You know, was there much dialogue that followed on from the talks themselves?
Yeah. Pretty typically, there's a fair bit, and I've had a few different kinds of things. Sometimes people will ask me about specific things that I've experienced. It's like, well, what is it like if, you know, when you have this kind of thing? So I've had a few questions like that. I've had some questions about, like somebody asked me about like, how do we help, you know, what are effective ways of like doing within an organization, like a workplace or something like that, that deals with mental health well, what are the steps? And I said, I am not sure because I haven't, I've had pretty okay experiences, but that's just not something I know a ton about. But generally most of the feedback I get, will come not just in the Q&A, but it'll come afterwards where people come up and talk to me. And I think that they feel comfortable sharing with me some of the experiences that they may have had with mental health, or say people who they're close to have had, because they see that I'm talking openly about it and they feel like they can kind of trust me about that. And I think that's good, right? I want people to be able to talk more openly about it. So the most common thing has been these, you know, where I get at least three or four people come up and talk to me and say, yeah, this is, you know, I have these kinds of issues, and to, you know, and talks to me about them, and or they say, yeah, my daughter or my sister or my brother or my wife or my husband or, you know, things like that, has gone through some of this stuff, and so just talking to me about that stuff. And a lot of times I try to take away from that and think about those experiences. And if there's something that I can take away from that and put back into my talks. I had a woman who talked to me about where she had been suffering from depression for like a decade until she was finally diagnosed with a particular thyroid disorder. And she had been tested for some thyroid issues, but wasn't tested for this particular thing. And that turned out to be the primary cause of her depression, was that her thyroid was basically pumping these hormones into her body that were causing it. And that is not surprising necessarily, but it took her a good 10 years to even find that out, right? And so that was an interesting thing. I've kind of tried to take that away from that, is that, well, this is an example. Sometimes it's not necessarily what, you know, the average person always expects. It can be a purely physical cause, you know, and maybe it's not related to a psychological trauma or something like that. So I think that, you know, those are really interesting. The other thing that I've done is there's a website called bluehackers.org. And at Open Source Bridge, there was a Birds of a Feather session that was sort of related to the Blue Hackers site. And I guess it was started at, there was a Linux conference in Australia, and they did one where it ends up being kind of a little bit like an informal group therapy session where folks just kind of get together and talk about if they want to talk about, you know, some of the stuff that they're dealing with, in a safe place where we don't, you know, share it with folks. And I, you know, took that from the experience I had at Open Source Bridge, and then did a couple of other ones of them. One at Lone Star PHP, and we did one at OSCON. I did one with Paul Fenwick, and who is also a great speaker and is talking about his struggles with depression. Really, really good stuff. He's PJF on Twitter, if you go there. So those have been really good and valuable and interesting, because I'm learning stuff from every one of those. You know, I'm learning what people's different experiences are like, and trying to take that into account, and feeling like, you know, it helps me better represent a little bit, and gives me a little bit more insight that I can share with other people. And that's been really good. But yeah, from the Q&A stuff, it's primarily been that. Like, the biggest thing I get is people coming up and talking to me about what their experiences have been like. And most of those have been pretty positive. And I felt like, hey, I dig where you're coming from. And it's been pretty good. I've had a couple where it was tough, because a guy talked to me some about a family member of his who has been dealing with stuff for a long time and really isn't probably able, isn't getting the treatment the person needs, and him trying to encourage her and he not knowing what to do, right? Because it's kind of feels like he can't do anything to sort of encourage her to sort of engage in her treatment and actively try to deal with it. And that was tough, because, you know, you can't make people do stuff, right? And that's ultimately a really, it's a painful thing, but something you kind of have to be able to forgive yourself for, is that you're not responsible for even a sibling's or a direct family member's happiness, right? That was a tough one, because there wasn't much I could really tell him. I felt like I wanted to have some good advice for this guy, right? Yeah. And I didn't have any good advice for him, other than to try to say, I wish there was something I could tell him, but I don't think that there's much you can do. You can't make somebody do something, and you can't make them change and decide, yes, I'm ready to get treated. So, you know, it doesn't work like that. We can't force people to do the things that we think they should do. And that was tough. Like, that was probably one of the toughest ones I've had in terms of feedback, because I just felt like I wish I had something better to tell him. And I knew it was hard, and it was really hard for this guy. I learned a lot from that too. You know, I think about his experiences and what he told me every time I speak, because that's part of it too. And he's not the only one who has had to deal with that, who's had a family member who struggles with this stuff, and it seems like he can't get them to sort of deal with the problem in a really productive, ongoing way. And that's pretty common. But that's part of it too, and that's part of the things that we need to understand and learn more about. So that was a tough thing, but in general, the Q&A is just super valuable. Then the feedback I get is super valuable from folks who are willing to come up to me and talk to me about it. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There seems to be a growing movement to do this type of thing. I'd heard of various talks, or at least a theme at the last Hackers on Planet Earth conference. I don't know if you spotted that at all yourself.
I don't think so, but let me look it up.
It was, I think it was the last Hope conference, whatever that was called, had something on mental health.
Yeah, it was mental health. I heard that as well.
Yeah.
And that was probably the most popular talk of the whole event.
Yeah, it looks as if, you know, there's a change coming. There's a change in attitude that somehow or other we people who suffer from this sort of thing are prepared to get out there and talk about it are starting and can push forward. You know.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's really encouraging. I think it's interesting that I think sometimes some of these things happen we're not conscious of there's some kind of movement or something like that, but. It's definitely the case that there are, people who sometimes it's just so sort of subconsciously that things that you see or hear people talking about sort of starts you thinking about that too. And so that has been, it does seem that way. It does seem like there's more people talking about this stuff within our sort of group is open source culture and tech culture. And I'm really encouraged by that. Like I said, I think Prompt, it started off where it features three folks who have been talking about this, and I'm one of them. And then, but encourages other people who, if they're speaking about this stuff to get in contact with them. And I think that's really, really good. And I know there's other people, like Paul Fenwick's been talking about this stuff, or for example, we started crossing paths because we were at some of the same conferences, right? And it's been really good. I've been very encouraged by that. I think that's been all very exciting and has kept me, for being a very cynical pessimist most of the time, cautiously optimistic. So,
that's good.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I feel good about it. I think more folks are talking about it. I like the idea that is going to increase awareness. And my hope is to keep that positive, sympathetic, and just to raise, more understanding about these kinds of things to have more empathy for folks who are going through this, to try to understand where they're, what they're struggling with and how to enable them to seek the help that they need. That's really what I hope is coming for that. And I think I think talking about this, that's going to happen. So, yeah.
The various links that you have on your website, I've followed a few of them on your OSMI page, and they look really good. I'm certainly going to delve into them in more depth. So thanks for those.
Oh, no problem. There's a couple ones that I sort of like to point out. There's DevPressed, which is a forum specifically for developers, and I guess it's not like other people can't talk on it, but it's kind of made for developers to talk about their mental health stuff that they're dealing with. That's a really good forum, I think. A podcast that I find really valuable. It can sometimes be kind of heavy in the sense that they talk about some pretty serious stuff, but there's a podcast done by a comedian called the Mental Illness Happy Hour that is really, really good. And I found it just very, very interesting. It's by a guy named Paul Gilmartin, who's a comedian in the US. And he has on lots of different people, some of them relatively famous comedians, some of them mental health experts, some of them people who have just struggled with mental health. And there's also a forum that's really good too. So it's pretty interesting stuff. Again, sometimes it's kind of heavy and, some of the topics are pretty, or it can be a little bit, if there's not a better word for it, triggering, in the sense that some of it is a little, sometimes they talk about some pretty serious and hard stuff, but it's really, really good. And to gain insight into what people go through and like what they struggle with, it's just been really, really valuable. So I just learned a ton from these and really super good stuff. I think there's some good resources out there. I think the key thing is that we can talk more openly about it. People are going to, understand better, how to deal with it, and they're going to be more willing to get help. And that's really the key, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool. Well, not cool, obviously.
No, that's pretty cool getting help. I like that part.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So the thing I struggle with is, I hear somebody's got some sort of mental health issue, what do you say to that person? Just freak and run away.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Super not helpful, I guess, really. But
the third time, I stopped doing that.
Oh, that's good. That's good of you. I think the thing that I found, and you know what, I'm going to bring up, because I have good notes on this, I'm actually going to open up one of my presentations, because I deal with this a little bit. When I have a slide about like helping people, like friends and coworkers, about stuff, and how do you do that? And you know, I'm not necessarily an expert on these things. I'm just a person who struggles with it. That doesn't mean that I know a ton about how you know, how to speak to people in really productive ways. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist. I don't really have any training in this stuff. But I think the key things is that oftentimes I get people say, oh, just take it easy, man. It's okay. You know, and a lot of times I know that the intention is to be like, oh, well, it's okay. That they don't intend to like be unhelpful, but things where it feels like the language is kind of dismissive of the problem, that usually makes it worse for me, at least. If somebody says something to me like, well, don't get your panties in a bunch or something like that, that is both kind of sexist and also very dismissive. Right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to deal with. And I don't, you know, I think there's four key things that I kind of put together. We're talking about, like, if you know, you know that a friend or a coworker is maybe having some problems with this stuff. And again, this is coming from my experience, and people are going to have different experiences here. But I guess the first thing I'd say is that I think it's really important to help them feel safe. And I know dealing with depression and anxiety, I think a lot of the key things is that, at least my anxiety is driven by this, you know, it's what anxiety is really ultimately not feeling safe for one reason or another, being worried about something. And so I think listening and trying to understand what it's like for the person is like really key. Just listening and saying, okay, can you tell me about that? Right. Can tell me what that's like. Right. Because the tendency is that people don't listen and really try to understand what it's like. They sort of think it's like my worry about Mondays, right, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's really not. It's a lot more severe. Even though it doesn't, and it's hard because it doesn't seem, it's like, why are they all worried about this? This isn't a big deal. Well, that's kind of the point, is that they have a problem where they worry about stuff where it actually, they shouldn't be worrying about it. But the problem is their body is reacting in that way anyway. Another thing is, I think acknowledging that the person is probably really frustrated, I think is helpful. You know, I know that I'm super frustrated with how I feel and how I'm behaving. You know, I talked about that, like, I logically know that I'm overreacting, but it doesn't change the fact that I feel like my brain and my body are screaming at me that something's wrong and I'm not comfortable in it, right? So
yeah, I do know what you mean.
The logic is kind of irrelevant, right? That's the whole point. That's the whole point of the problem, is that you're having it when it doesn't make sense to. And you have it, unfortunately, it can become like a constant problem. That's why I have generalized anxiety disorder, because it's not tied to a particular thing. Like, I'm afraid of, say, swimming, or I'm afraid of flying. No, it's about a lot of stuff like that doesn't, you know, that, and all of those things, I should say, you know, fear of those things, those are all legitimate issues that people have to deal with, and those are fine. In my case, I have a generalized anxiety disorder where I feel anxiety about lots of different situations, without good reason, you know, that where I have a much more severe reaction than I should. And I'm very frustrated by that. I know that it makes things harder for people around me because I'm like this. And I don't like that. I know that it makes it harder to deal with me when I'm in a bad mood. And that I can have a mood swing really fast and get in a really like shitty mood. And people don't think that that's, you know, then the people who have to deal with me at work or in my family or things like that in other parts of my life, they have to put up with that and they have to learn how to deal with that. And that's not fun. And I know that it makes things harder for them and I don't like doing that. Right. Go ahead.
But on one hand, at least there's an explanation. You know what I mean? You know,
yeah, somebody's just absolutely.
Not, at least you can look at the checklist and go, okay, what happened there? Did he take his meds? Did he blah, blah, blah? Did he blah, blah, blah? Oh, right. He might not have slept well last night. Just...
Yeah, and certainly those kinds of things contribute to that. So that's certainly the case. I think the thing for me, because dealing with anxiety, change is really, really scary for me. And this comes up a lot if you're like if you work in IT or any kind of workplace, really. But I think change is hard for a lot of people and it tends to make people uncomfortable, right? But it's really, really hard if something is happening that's putting us out of our sort of comfort zone, and that's really scary. And the worst times I've had, like finding out something, like the worst place to tell me something that might be like that is like in the middle of a meeting with like 30 other people, right? That's really hard.
Yeah, I can see.
You know, and I where it's like, I feel like I can't really say anything and we're not in a one-on-one sort of dialogue where maybe I can say that makes me kind of uncomfortable or things like that. And I can kind of talk about how it makes me feel particularly. I don't want to say anything because I feel like I'll put myself out there as if like, well, why can't he handle it? Right. And what's his problem? And that's a hard thing to deal with. So I often find that it's like important to like talk to a person about how they feel and what they need. You know, if you know somebody who has struggles, particularly with anxiety, like I do, ask them like, and maybe talk to them one-on-one, like ahead of time. And maybe say, hey, this is something that's going on. Yeah. And here's, you know, and I want to hear from you how that makes you feel and what we can do to help you, right? That immediately makes me feel better because I now feel like I can trust you to be honest with you about how I feel and that you want to help me, right? And I can tell you it would really help me if this happened or if I could do this or if I could deal with it in this way or things like that. Or we can just keep talking about it. And that your door's open or whatever. That makes it, for me, a huge difference. And then the other thing I kind of list out is that if you know somebody who's struggling with this stuff, they may not need this, but encourage them. And then the second thing to seek help, and the second thing is to enable them to seek help. In the sense that if you're in a position where you have some control over their ability to go out and seek help, or you are in a position where you can help them identify resources that may be available to them, but they're not sure about how to get to, or they may struggle with the process of seeking out those resources. And you can really enable them by having some of those things handy and say, especially people who in the U.S. say don't have medical insurance, that's really problematic. And if they have private medical insurance, sometimes it differs like what is going to get covered in terms of mental health. It's not as like, you know, if you get diabetes, it's pretty clear you can go get help for that. But there's often completely different terms like for what you can get help you can get for mental health. And it's much more complex and, you know, you don't really know where to go and things like that. But typically there's resources available to people, but it's not necessarily well known like where you would go and where to start. A lot of times it's really scary to start. So encouraging them and enabling them to seek help, I think, is really important. So for folks who, if you're working with people or you have friends or things like that, you know, being able to do that, I think, helps a lot. Those are things that, like I said, I get tons of feedback from people who say that, who've talked about how they have really not been willing to seek treatment. And sometimes they'll say, I sort of feel like maybe I can now after I hear a talk. So what that tells me is that there's tons of people out there who are struggling with stuff and they're scared for one reason or another or unwilling to seek help. And, helping them along a little bit and sort of like, sort of lowering that hump they have to get over to do it. If you can help them with that some. You know, I talked before, you can't make people do stuff. You can't make them help themselves, right? But there's things you can do to make it easier. And you make it easier if you say, you know, maybe help them out and here's some resources for you. Maybe you could go talk to this person or things like that. And, you know, if you want to talk to me later, that's okay. You know, I'm here. If you want to, you know, if you're just scared or something, you can talk to me and that's all right. You know, being able to do that, I think helps a lot. So those are like the things I always like in my talk, I try to bring up in terms of helping folks who, if you know, that are going through some of this stuff.
I suppose everybody's condition is kind of different, what you can do, or, you know, I suppose the only thing you can ask is, you know, what can I do to help, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It is different for everybody, and there's common traits. I mean, that's why they're able to group things under different, you know, conditions and disorders and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, figuring this stuff out is really, it's a personal thing where you have to, you know, you have to engage in your treatment is what I say. And in some sense, this is kind of scary, but you kind of have to take responsibility for yourself in terms of, I need to figure out what it's like, you know, what I need. And it's a little different than, because of our not always very good understanding of how these things work, it's different than you go into a doctor and the doctor does some tests and says, you have this condition, this is what you need to do.
Yeah.
Typically, for this kind of thing, somebody is going to listen to what you describe as your symptoms. And then, based on what you say and how you explain it, they're going to try to offer potential solutions for you. And that's like, if that in and of itself is very different, because it is very much how you describe it. So you need to be kind of like, to get the best and most effective treatment, you need to be pretty aware of, like, self-aware, right? You need to be thinking about, how am I feeling today? What are the patterns that I see in my behavior? You know, what are the kinds of things that trigger me to feel a certain way? How do I describe how I feel? And that really gets it across, things like that. Right. And so because it relies so much on that, and there often aren't, like, there aren't obvious biological things they can test for and say, oh, your brain is behaving that way, and we know exactly how to treat that. Right. Well, it doesn't work that way now, at least. Right. So that it's pretty different, and that's where it's really got to be, like, you need to learn how to communicate about how you're feeling. And that's really hard for a lot of people, because it's very scary for them to talk about it. You know, and so that's where it's like, you try to find somebody who you trust to talk about those kinds of things. You find a therapist who you feel comfortable with to talk about that stuff, and kind of go from there.
Yeah. Yeah, just two things I would say about that. One is, we seem, as far as mental health issues, we seem to be like in the age of leeches and, you know, boils, piercing boils, as far as, we've had some series here on HPR in relation to schizophrenia, and it doesn't seem to be very, well, scientific, to be completely honest with you.
No, I think there's some conditions we understand better. I think we have a better handle on depression, for example. And we've learned some things about how we think that the biology works behind it. But the interesting thing is, it talked about that Robert Sapolsky talk. He says, he goes into some detail about, like, how we think neurotransmitters work, and what are the neurotransmitters we think are related to depression and or, you know, the lack of those neurotransmitters or what have you, and relate to that. And but he talks about it, he says, okay, so we know this stuff, and we have these medications that will help treat those, say, deficiencies in certain neurotransmitters. And what turns out is that if you just treat the biological symptoms, you only help about 30% of people. So what that says is that our understanding of it is still pretty poor. We don't, for most of these things, have necessarily biological markers for them. Like I said, it's not like you can necessarily test for it. You have to listen to people and what they describe. And oftentimes we just don't understand why the brain behaves the way it does. So we don't exactly know how to treat it. What we do know is that we have some medications that it seems like they help. I definitely take some medications where I look up where it says, you know, they did different testing, and obviously they do testing and to see that it doesn't seem to actually, like, say, kill people or stuff like that. And then they think that, well, the way that this structure is, we think that it may help with this because we think that this chemical has something to do with the way that, like, say, people feeling anxious or something like that. And, you know, there'll be a description for a lot of drugs for mental illnesses that will say that we think that the way it works is X, but they really don't know exactly how it works. But they're speculating that we think this is what's going on, but you don't really know that. And it's just because our understanding of what these things are is not that great. You know, that's kind of the nature of it as it is right now. And so that can be a tough thing to deal with, right? Because it's so wide-ranging, there's going to be conditions that aren't dealt with as well. You know, and schizophrenia can be one of them, where I don't know a great deal about it, but I know that it's very difficult for people to deal with. But there are some medications that help. Sometimes they have tough side effects, that can be really problematic for people too. That's a pretty common thing, I think. You know, I think medications for things like depression and anxiety have gotten better, and I think our understanding of it has gotten some better, but it's still not great, and it still requires us to kind of feel out things and try to figure out what works and what doesn't. We do not have a complete understanding of, like, how the brain and it is interacting with the rest of the body and exactly, okay, you know, from this to this to this, this is exactly why that's happening. And we don't have that.
I think, and I suppose, what you're doing here is you're making this more public, at least among the community of hackers and so forth. And hopefully people will start coming out of the woodwork and the stigma of this will be removed, and the research that is due to this will be hopefully assigned.
Yes, that is exactly what I hope for. So
that'd be a good plan, eh?
Close
that bug.
I think that would be awesome. That'd be awesome. So that's exactly what I hope for. You know, like I said, right now it's really, I feel like, if I keep talking about this and other people keep talking about this, things are going to grow out of that. And I expect that, you know, resources are going to pop up more about this stuff as we keep doing that. Like the way that open source does, you know, the more, you know, it, a lot of time things tend to happen organically. And so resources tend to pop up where people feel that they can contribute and people feel that they can help. And that's what I expect to happen here. So I think we're kind of on the cusp of, some really good stuff, and I'm excited about it. So that's it. I'm just going to keep talking.
Unfortunately, yeah. We have no time limit here in HBR, so you can continue talking for as long as you like.
Yes, probably could. Eventually my family will come home, or my voice will run out. So I might have to give up eventually. But yeah.
Well, links to all the stuff that you've spoken about I have here, and they'll be added in the show notes.
Oh, that's great.
See some of the stuff. Even the lecture is Creative Commons by SA, which is completely compatible with HBR here.
So yes. I'll
probably throw that in the queue as well at some stage.
Yeah, please feel free. If people, you know, I had a couple questions about it. And I said, well, I don't care what you do with it. I would like it if you at least, you know, gave me an acknowledgement of what you do. But if you need to take these resources and if I've done some stuff that's helpful to help, you know, prompt you to do something and maybe talk about some stuff or share some things with people, please go ahead. Right. And that's where I wanted to take it. So I did go through and made all the talks and all the slides. CC by SA. So you should be able to do pretty much whatever you want to with it. Please don't do something bad with it. But
no.
Other than that, you know, I meant you in general.
I don't do that anyway. Everybody.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, yeah, please feel free if you want to rebroadcast or you want to just share, whatever, that's totally fine. So that would be great. That would be awesome. Please do that.
Anyone else got any closing questions?
No, none for me.
No.
All righty.
Cool. We fixed mental illness. Excellent. Next thing.
Yeah, it's all done.
Job done.
Problem solved.
Is there a place? What I'm concerned about is that if you're next year running an Indiegogo campaign and we don't hear about it, how can we keep up with it?
Well, my website is funkatron.com, and I try to keep stuff posted there. Probably the other place that's easiest to follow me is on Twitter, if you can handle me cracking wise about lots of stuff. But that's the other place to hear it. But my website, funkatron.com, you know, is obviously RSS feed from that and things like that. So that would probably be the best way, either that or my Twitter account, which is just Funkatron. Cool. So, yeah.
Links will be in the show notes.
Absolutely. So very good. Yeah, those would be the best ways to keep up. So I'll keep talking about this stuff. And please, you know, visit Prompt, too, the prompt.engineyard.com. If you have things that you can offer, if you're doing a conference and want to have somebody come and speak about some stuff, if you're an organization that wants to get involved in helping support people who are speaking about this with their costs, we really want you to get involved, and that would be super, super helpful. So I think there's good things happening there.
Cool. Thank you very much, Ed, for
thanks.
And, we do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's really cool.
No problem. Yeah, thanks, Ed.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I will talk to you guys soon.
All righty.
Thank you.
And everybody, tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of
Hacker Public Radio.
Stanford University.
Okay, there are all sorts of interesting diseases out there, and lots of them are quite exotic. You've got elephant man syndrome, and you've got progeria, which is a disease where you basically die of old age when you're about 10 years old, and then you've got cannibals eating brains and getting prion diseases, and those are very exciting, and they're great and great, you know, junior high school papers about disease and such. Oh, no. Okay, come up to the front, please. See, a couple more seats. So there are all sorts of these great made-for-TV movie diseases out there. But when you want to come to, say, basic meat and potatoes of human medical misery, there is nothing out there like depression. Depression is absolutely crippling. Depression is incredibly pervasive and thus important to talk about. I'll make the argument here today, a number of things, but one critical thing being that basically depression is like the worst disease you can get. And I'll make the argument for that in a bit. It is devastating. It is wildly common. Current estimates are 15% of us in this room will have a major depression at some point or other in our lives. So that is not good. What is also clear is it is worldwide. Currently, World Health Organization says depression is the number four cause of disability on this planet. And by the year 2025, it's going to be number two after obesity, diabetes-related disorders. So it is bad news, and it is becoming more common. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today are seemingly two very, very different topics and tie them together at the end. And what the main point is if you live inside only one of those topics, you're not going to understand this disease at all. First topic being, what does biology have to do with depression? Second topic being, what does psychology have to do with it? Okay, so starting off, first being a sense of symptoms. And right off the bat, we've got a semantic problem, which is we all use the word depression in an everyday sense. You get some bad news about something, you know, to replace the transmission in your car, somebody disappoints you enormously, and you feel bummed, you feel depressed, you were down for a few days. That's not the version of depression I'll be talking about. Next version, you do have some sort of large, legitimate loss, setback, whatever, losing a job, unemployment, death of a loved one, and you are extremely impaired by a sense of malaise for weeks afterward. and then you come out the other end. That's sort of what I'll be talking about. But even more so, what I'll focus on is the subset of individuals who, when something like that occurs, falls into this depressive state, and weeks and months later, they still have not come out the other end. Terminology, the everyday depression that we all have now and then, that sort of version. The second one, the something awful happens and you feel terrible for a while and then come out the other end, a reactive depression. The third version, where you are flattened by it for long periods afterward, a major depression. And what you also see with people with major depression after a while is it doesn't take something awful externally to trigger one of those again. Okay, so what are the symptoms about? If I had to define major depression in one sentence, I would say it's a biochemical disorder with a genetic component and early experience influences where somebody can't appreciate sunsets. And that's what this disease is about. And when you think about it, that is a very sad thing. You look at some of our major diseases, somebody with cancer, somebody crippled by heart disease, and you see the most unlikely things out there. You see somebody saying, well, obviously I'm not glad I'm dying of cancer, but without this disease, I never would have realized the importance of friends. I never would have reconciled with my family members. I never would have found my God on a completely weird level. I'm almost glad this has happened to me. Humans have this astonishing capacity to derive pleasure out of the most unlikely domains. What could possibly be worse than a disease whose defining symptom is the inability to feel pleasure? Thus, at the top of the list, anhedonia. Hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure, that is what a depression is about. And you get someone who has just had some enormous good luck, a long-sought relationship, works out well, whatever, and they feel nothing. An inability to feel pleasure, way at the top of the list. What else? Grief, guilt, and that's where we've got the semantic problem again, which is the everyday sort of depression. Something happens, bumps us out, and by definition, we are feeling some version of grief. Often we start obsessing at that point over some miserable thing we did to somebody 12 years ago and sort of despair in that. When you're talking about major depression, the grief and the guilt can be so severe that it actually takes on a delusional quality. Okay, not delusional in the sense of the schizophrenic with delusions, hearing voices, thought disorder, but a certain style of extreme depression. Let me give you an example. You have late middle-aged guy, perfectly healthy, and suddenly out of nowhere, he has a major heart attack. He's lying there in the hospital, and the reality is he's going to recover. He's going to have to make some changes in his lifestyle, but he's going to recover. He instead falls into a major depression. This has transformed his sense of who he is. Suddenly he's an old man. Suddenly there's all these things he can't do. He falls into a major depression. Yet, he's recovering. Every day, his family is in there saying, look, you're just depressed. You're getting stronger. The doctors are saying you're getting stronger. You're just depressed. It happens the hospital is circular. It has a corridor that forms a circle in it. And one day the family's in there saying, you're getting stronger. Look, the nurses said yesterday you did one loop around the hospital, and today you did two loops. You're getting better. You're getting stronger. And the person says, no. You don't understand. They're doing some construction. Last night they closed down the outer corridor, and they opened up a new little one. So there are two versions of this one. Two loops there, shorter than the large one. I'm getting weaker. I'm going to die. This is like someone expecting to believe that last night they were like beavers digging through the walls there, making this new. This was the father of an acquaintance of mine, a structural engineer. This is what a structural engineer looks like when they're delusional to the point of saying that this is a world in which everything is inevitably getting worse. Depression built around that. Next, of course, one of the most dramatic and one of the most awful symptoms of depression, self-injury. Depressives mutilating themselves at a high rate, and of course, most notoriously, suicide, risks of suicide, and that is absolutely tragic. In teenagers, early adults, that along with accidents is the leading cause of death, major bad news. Another set of symptoms that wind up being informative, something called psychomotor retardation. everything is exhausting. It's exhausting to do stuff. It's exhausting to think stuff. You were there and, you know, you can't do the laundry because where's the basket? And you got to find change for the machine and you got to go get detergent and just, it's too much. Everything is too much and you fall into this paralyzed state. Something very interesting in that regard. You get someone who is severely depressed, like to the point of hospitalization, and when they are absolutely crippled with psychomotor retardation, that's not when you worry about suicide. This is someone who's having enough trouble getting out of bed and getting dressed each day, they're not going to figure out how to shred the hospital mattress and make a noose out of it. Where you've got your problems is when somebody begins to get better. From a severe depression, when they're starting to come out, that's where the psychomotor retardation relieves enough that suddenly they've got the energy to do something catastrophic. That's when people are on suicide watches, when you have clinicians who are oriented well. Next, something really interesting. And in lots of ways, the single point I want to hammer in here over and over and over is something that people with depression constantly battle with. Back to semantics. We all get depressed. Bad stuff happens to us. We all get depressed. We feel lousy. We feel withdrawn. We feel sort of a sense of grief, and we're not taking much pleasure, and we withdraw. And then we get better. We cope. We heal. We deal with things in life. What's the deal with you that you can't do that? And there's this lurking sense, given that all of us have periods of being depressed and come out the other end, when you look at people who instead go down and stay down there to this crippling extent, there's always this little voice between the lines there of, come on, pull yourself together. We all deal with this sort of thing. I will make the argument throughout here that depression is as real of a biological disorder as is juvenile diabetes. And you don't sit down a diabetic and say, oh, come on, what's with this insulin stuff? Stop babying yourself and pull it together. You will see this is just as much of a biological disorder. Part of what makes that clear are a bunch of symptoms called vegetative symptoms. The bodies of major depressives work differently. First set of symptoms. No surprise, lots of people have trouble sleeping when they're having everyday off-the-rack depression. There's a certain pattern with people with major depression. What would you think? You know, you're depressed, you have trouble falling asleep, toss and turn. That's not what you see with a major depressive. Instead, you wake up early. You wake up 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, you're exhausted, but you're not going to sleep. Early morning wakening. You wind up in an emergency room somewhere, deeply depressed, and the clinician there better ask you at some point, how's your sleep been? Do you tend to wake up early in the day? Early morning wakening, classic sign. Additional thing, sleep is not this monolithic process. There's all these different stages of sleep, slow wave sleep, deep sleep, REM sleep, all of that. There's a structure, an architecture to how we sleep, sort of 90-minute cycles as you go through the different phases. You look at the brain of somebody with depression while they're sleeping, and these different phases are completely disordered. The whole structure of sleep goes down the tubes. Look at somebody when they're sound asleep and their brain sleeps differently. This is not, oh, come on, stop babying yourself. This screams biology. More versions of it. Most of us, what we do when we're feeling kind of down is we eat more. Out of this general belief that when you feel unloved, carbohydrates make you feel better. And bizarrely, there's actually a brain chemistry of it, of carbohydrates decrease stress hormone release. So for most of us, you're feeling bummed out about things, you eat more. That's not what you see in major depression, decreased appetite. Another thing you see is activation of the stress response. A class of stress hormones are highly elevated in people with major depression. You also have overactivation of something that's called the sympathetic nervous system, adrenaline. Overactivity of these components of the stress response, and that's really important. Because you look at someone with a major depression who's just mired in the psychomotor retardation stuff, and there's this temptation to start thinking about them as some sort of like sea sponge, some invertebrate thing where you're just so wiped out, you can't even get out of bed. It is just debilitating in that sense. That's not what's going on during depression. What you have instead is somebody whose body is blasting through their overactivated stress response, this enormous battle, all of it going on internally. And the fact that you see changes like these tell you this is not, oh, just so wiped out you can't even activate. This is someone whose body is having a massive stress response 24/7. There's a huge battle going on, and it's all internally, increased metabolic rate, increased muscle tone, all of this again screaming biology. The final thing that says tons of biology is lots of people with major depression have rhythmic patterns to the depression. You will get somebody where they will fall into a depression, where it will have 2 months of extreme severe symptoms, debilitating, come out the other end, and a year and a half later, the exact same pattern, a year and a half later, exact same thing. You have some people who only get their depressions during the winter. Something known as seasonal affective disorders, SADs, and this is someone where something horrible happens to them in June, and they feel sort of sad for a couple of weeks, and they come out the other end, and nothing happens in January, and they fall into a depression, and they're hospitalized for a month and a half, just like every January for the last 10 years. And you see that, and that is all about biological clocks that are out of whack there. It's biology. This is not, oh, come on, pull it together. Okay, so hopefully what that begins to introduce is the notion, amid all these debilitating symptoms, these are ones that are about biology. These are bodies working differently. So starting to focus in more on the biology of it. What's going on in the brain in major depression? What I'll start off with is the chemistry of it. Okay, what we got here, do not panic if you are not sort of familiar with this and have not wanted to think about science since high school sort of thing. You got two brain cells. You got two neurons. The way they talk to each other, they don't actually touch each other. In order for one neuron to send a message to another one, it needs to release a chemical messenger that goes floating over here and does something or other to this neuron. Chemical messenger called a neurotransmitter. And here we have a case of this, and by law, all neurons go from left to right. So this is a cell that continues down this way. It's all excited. It's trying to pass on some news to this neuron. There's a space in between called the synapse. And what this one is doing, because it's all excited, it has these little water balloons filled with neurotransmitters. Excitation signal comes along, dumps the neurotransmitters. They go floating across the synapse, bind to a receptor there, and then suddenly, something changes in this neuron. That's how neurons talk to each other. How many different types of neurotransmitters there are? Probably hundreds. And what will be pertinent here is, in depression, there's just a handful of them that seem to be implicated. First neurotransmitter, something called norepinephrine. Norepinephrine first got implicated in depression in the early 50s, in the early 60s, rather. What was the evidence? Around that time, the first generation of antidepressant drugs had been developed, something called MAO inhibitors. What do they do? Okay, so you got your neurotransmitters released, because this neuron's excited. What do you have to do? It comes out, it does its thing with receptors, and then you have to clean up after yourself. You've like dumped all the stuff in the synapse. What do you do then? You got two options. You can take the neurotransmitter and you can be green in your orientation. You can recycle it. You could take it back up in here and stick it back into one of these. You can do this recycling business. Or you could be terrible and carbon footprint. You can throw out your neurotransmitter. There's like enzymes sitting around here that break it up and flush it down the toilet. What's the toilet? Out into your cerebral spinal fluid, your bloodstream, your urine, whatever. So either recycling or degrade this stuff. So what do these MAO inhibitors do? They inhibit the activity of this enzyme that breaks down norepinephrine. Okay, so what's the logic there? So you inhibit the activity of this enzyme. You don't break down norepinephrine. So it's just floating around there, and for lack of anything else to do, it hits the receptor a second time, and a third time, and a gazillionth time. And suddenly, somebody's depression goes away. What's your theory have to be at that point? Ooh, I bet there wasn't enough norepinephrine coming out. You find a means to increase the signaling, somebody gets better, and you now hypothesize there's a problem with too little norepinephrine. By the late 60s, another class of antidepressants came in called tricyclic antidepressants. What do they do? Essentially the same exact thing. What they do is they gum up this pump that recycles the stuff. Norepinephrine doesn't get removed from the synapse, has nothing else to do, hits the receptor second, third, tenth time, person feels better. Ooh, I think the problem in my theory is too little norepinephrine coming out. Thus, the norepinephrine hypothesis. More evidence for it, there are classes of drugs that will decrease your norepinephrine release. Why would you want to do that? In some parts of the body, an excess of norepinephrine has something to do with high blood pressure. So you take a class of drugs, something called reserpine, and what it does is it disintegrates these things. And thus, you don't dump as much norepinephrine. Major side effect in lowering somebody's blood pressure that way is they fall into a depression. So you take a depressed person, you find a way of boosting up their norepinephrine signaling, they feel better. You take a normal person, you drive down their norepinephrine signaling, they get depressed, there's got to be a problem here of too little norepinephrine. So that's incredibly convincing. So at this point, what you got to say is, okay, great, that's convincing, that's irrefutable. What does norepinephrine do? And people figured it out in the 50s, and it's got something to do with this. Take a rat and take a certain part of the brain, you put an electrode down in there where you can stimulate the neurons, you can force them to talk to each other when otherwise they have nothing to say, stimulate this pathway, and what you do is you make a rat unbelievably happy. Okay, so of course the question is, how do you tell when a rat's unbelievably happy? What you do is you make it work in order to get stimulated there. It presses a lever, and it presses a lever 25 times, and it gets a little buzz there, and it does another time, and rats will work themselves to death to get stimulated in this area. It is better than food. It is better than sex. If they're addicted to a drug and going through withdrawal, it is better than the drug. And what you see is this mediates pure pleasure, and this was called the pleasure pathway in the 1950s. So, of course, you look at it, and then what you have to then say is, ooh, do we have the same pathway? Can I get a new one? Can I get a second one? Shortly after that, people went looking and saw the exact same thing in humans. And this would be during neurosurgery, sort of classical neurosurgical techniques. You don't anesthetize the person. The brain doesn't feel pain. Once you've anesthetized the skin and the skull, you get through there, and you can actually keep somebody awake during surgery. And they used to need to do that, because you put your little needle down in one part of the brain, and the person flaps their arm, and another part, and they say the Pledge of Allegiance or whatever. And then you look at your little road map, and it says, okay, go three neurons and make a left. People had to do that. So it was around the early 60s that people started stimulating the same area in the human brain. And it is unbelievable what you got. There were transcripts of some of these, and you read it, and the person is going on, and you're seeing stuff like, oh, that's great, that's great. That's kind of like sex, but you know when you have this itch, and finally you get to scratch it, and then, oh, it's like getting back into bed. And you know, remember how, like in the fall, you'd go out and play in the leaves, and mom would call you in, and she'd make cookies, and then you get into your jammies with the feet on. They just go on like that. Where can you sign up and have this happen? The same exact sort of theme as in a rat. And it was around that time that people discovered that in this pathway, it uses norepinephrine. Aha. So if you've got a shortage of norepinephrine in that part of the brain, what have you just explained? That's the loss of pleasure. Great. Utterly convincing. Here's all the reasons why you shouldn't be convinced. Problems began to emerge. First problem was, there's something weird with the time course. You throw in any of the drugs I just talked about, and norepinephrine signaling is changing within like an hour. You put a depressed person on those drugs, and they don't get better for a couple of weeks. Something isn't working there. So that was mysterious. Next problem was, it turned out norepinephrine is useful in this pathway. Another neurotransmitter turned out to be even more important, neurotransmitter called dopamine. Dopamine, cocaine works on dopamine systems. So suddenly norepinephrine is just a minor player in this pleasure pathway stuff. But the biggest problem came in the late 80s with the introduction of Prozac. Prozac, which is an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, what that does is work on a completely different neurotransmitter system, this neurotransmitter called serotonin. What that drug does is it does the same deal, it stops the reuptake, increased serotonin signaling, and then once your hypothesis, ooh, you give somebody a Prozac SSRI, they feel better, I bet you there was too little serotonin. So it was during this period where there was just endless tragic, you know, drive-by shootings of norepinephrine people by the serotonin crowd and the other one had huge, huge controversy. And of course, like the middle of the road liberals, and why can't they all get along? It starts sort of suggesting that, oh, maybe it's got something to do with norepinephrine and serotonin and dopamine and everybody hold hands and, you know, and that's absolutely what's going on. The best evidence at this point to be insanely simplistic is that dopamine has something to do with the anhedonia, an absence of dopamine. The absence of norepinephrine has something to do with the psychomotor retardation. The absence of serotonin is this obsessive sense of grief. And interestingly, supporting that notion is you can have an obsessive sense of something else. You can have an obsessive need to keep your utensils perfectly symmetrical and obsessively wash your hands 8 hours a day. Obsessive compulsive disorder, that's helped by SSRIs like Prozac as well. Whatever it is you are just perseverating over like mad, getting increasing serotonin signaling can help. So you've got at least three different neurotransmitters relevant to the pleasure, the psychomotor retardation, all of this, all sorts of other leads floating around in the field. There's a neurotransmitter called substance P. And what substance P is about is pain. Like, poke your finger and your spinal cord, there's neurons there are releasing substance P talking to each other. It's about pain. It's about chronic pain syndromes. It's about whole body burns. Everybody knew this. And then it was discovered that if you get a drug that decreases substance P signaling, sometimes depressives get better. What does that suggest? It is not just a metaphor of depression as psychic pain. Your body is using the same brain chemistry to feel this sort of psychic pain of depression as just telling you, ooh, I just stubbed my toe. Interesting similarities there. Okay, so we got something about the neurochemistry. How about the neuroanatomy, the structure of the brain? And what you've got here is, this is the human brain. This is exactly what it looks like. It comes in three colors. And this was this formulation that came out during the 40s called the triune brain concept, which winds up being really, really explanatory. Down here at the bottom, you've got the really boring nuts and bolts part of the brain. And there's this term, this is the reptilian part of the brain. Take a lizard, and it's basically the exact same stuff down there. What does this part of the brain do? Like regulatory, boring things. It measures your blood glucose levels, or if your blood pressure is dropped, it sends out a signal to tighten up your blood vessels. Just total boring plumbing type issues. Sitting on top of it is a much more interesting brain region called the limbic system. Limbic system is about emotion. You don't see a big limbic system until you get to mammals. Lizards are not famous for their emotional lives. Limbic system is much more about emotive stuff, fear and lust and anger and rage and poignance and God knows what. What you've got there are all sorts of ways where the limbic system talks to this part of the brain. And what it does is, rather than you being hemorrhaged, ooh, part this brain, or your body getting cold, whatever, you're some, you know, elk, and there's some scary other elk there that's got you all upset, and you start secreting stress hormones, that's your limbic system saying, ooh, I don't like the smell of that guy talking down there. All sorts of means by which your emotional part of the brain can talk to stuff down here. Then you got the really interesting area up on top, the cortex. Cortex, all sorts of creatures out there have cortexes. We got more than anybody. It is this hugely expanded area. In primates, we proportionally have the biggest one out there. What does cortex do? It makes you do your taxes and does like processing visual information and tells you, aha, that's, you know, punk rock, and that's not Beethoven, and all sorts of sensory stuff, associative cortex things. But then there's an interesting part of the cortex that's very relevant to all of this. Okay, suppose you finish the lecture, you go outside, unexpectedly you are gored by an elephant. What are you going to do? You are going to activate your stress response. You may feel a sense of grief at that point. You may kind of hunker down at that point, a little psychomotor retardation. Appetite, there goes the dinner arrangements. You know, sex may not be the most appealing thing under that context. You are having a stress response in response to the sort of insult that this part of the brain is thinking about. So what's a depression? You sit there and you think about kids in refugee camps, you think about the inevitable mortality of your loved ones, you think about whatever, and suddenly your body does the exact same thing as if you were gored by an elephant. And what's going on there is you get the feelings, the abstract sort of depressive stuff there, and this part of the brain is able to make the rest of the brain go along with it as if this was an elephant goring you. On a certain totally simplistic level, what depression is about is the cortex whispering in the ear of the rest of the brain saying, this is as real as you were just physically assaulted by some sort of predator, whatever, and you turn on the exact same thing. On a very simplistic level, what a depression is a cortex having too many sad thoughts and getting the rest of the brain to go along with it. Okay, so that's how you think about depression, which is insanely simplistic. You can come up with an insanely simplistic treatment for depression, which is get yourself a pair of scissors and just and separate that part of the brain from the rest of it, and you're home free. That's your, oh yeah, right. Well, that's certainly an advance in medicine. That is a medical procedure. It is called a cingulotomy. The part of the cortex is called the anterior cingulate, a cingulotomy or a cingulum bundle cut. And what you do is you sever this pathway and people get less depressed at that point. Okay, when does this happen? This is someone where every type of medication and every type of therapy and electroshock interventions, all of that has been tried and every combination, and they're still on the back ward of the state hospital slashing their wrists every 3 months. That's when people try this. And the amazing thing of this desperate measure is people get less depressed at this point. Okay, so at that point you may want to look at that and say, well, anything else about these people when you've gone through there and just snipped away? Mind you, this is not a frontal lobotomy. Frontal lobotomy is doing something very undefined up there, but instead you're disconnecting here. What else is up with somebody when you've just disconnected part of their cortex from the rest of the brain? Ooh, insofar as the cortex can come up with abstractly sad thoughts and get the rest of the brain to go along with it, maybe the cortex also comes up with abstractly pleasurable thoughts and gets the rest of the brain. Have you just wiped out somebody's ability to have abstract pleasure? Absolutely. So suddenly you are off and running with a great philosophy term paper. Ooh, it's important that we have pain in order to have pleasure and all. This is nonsense. You get someone who's a candidate for this procedure back in the state hospital there with a wrist scarred over, and this is not somebody feeling a whole lot of abstract pleasure anyway. So what does this tell us? You come up with some ridiculously simplistic explanation that, ooh, you make it impossible for this sad part of the brain to whisper sad thoughts. The rest of the brain, the best people in the field thinking about this, can't come up with anything a lot more sophisticated than that. So that tells you something about the brain structure with depression. Final bit of biology here, hormones. What do hormones have to do with it? One very important domain of hormones. You take somebody and they're having problems with a class of hormones, thyroid hormones. What thyroid hormones are about is maintaining your metabolism, keeping your body warm enough, all that sort of stuff. If you have a severe shortage of thyroid hormone, lots of things happen, including you fall into a major depression. Hypothyroidism is associated with major depression. There's an autoimmune disease called Hashimoto's disease, which involves problems with secreting thyroid hormone, and that's a basic feature of it. And somebody comes in, and you diagnose it, and you give them normal levels of thyroid hormone, and away goes their depression. Lots of lessons with that. First one is, best estimates are about 20% of major depressions are undiagnosed hypothyroid syndromes instead. The next one it demonstrates is, you better, when somebody is thinking about your psychiatric state, you better have somebody there who's thinking about your nutrition, your hormone levels, your nothing about what's going on here is independent of the rest of the body. So a big role for thyroid hormones. Next domain of hormones being relevant. You take women. You take women, and they have a higher incidence of major depression than men do, approximately twice the rate. In addition, women have their highest vulnerability to depression at certain points in their reproductive life histories. After you've given birth, a postparturition depression, around the time of your period, around the time of menopause, all of these scream biology. So you look at why women have elevated rates of depression, and there's biology, there's all sorts of other schools of thought that have gone into it. There are ones having more kind of sociological framework. Lack of control can cause depression in society after society. Women traditionally have less control. No wonder they fall into more depression. There's another school that focuses on a certain style of emotional differences you see between the genders. On the average, women tend to ruminate more on emotionally upsetting things, to focus in on more. And this sounds totally stereotypical, and when you do the studies, there's overlaps between individuals, but nonetheless, on the average, what you see is these sorts of studies where you get someone after they just had a fight with a close friend, and what do women do when they give a choice of a whole bunch of activities? They choose to fill out questionnaires about how they met their friend, and what their relationship is, and does the friend have a good marriage, and all of that. You do it to guys, and they fill out questionnaires about, like, trivia questions about the Civil War. Oh my God, they can't express their emotions. No wonder they're impossible. And of course, again, individual variation. This is highly stereotyping. On the average, though, women ruminate more on upsetting emotions than men do. So that is solid science. What is completely unsolid science is the speculation at that point that if you ruminate on bad feelings, you're more prone to a depression. So that's a whole emotional regulation argument. But you come back to that business of women are most at risk for depression in the 2 weeks after giving birth, around the period of their periods, menopause, and that's all about hormones. And by now, there's a huge literature having to do with the effects on all that stuff over there of estrogen and progesterone, and probably most importantly, the ratio of estrogen to progesterone, and what's going on around giving birth, one's period, levels of this stuff is just shooting around all over the place, and the sense is something goes out of whack with the ratios there, and everything about estrogen, progesterone, and the ratio can change the number of receptors for these neurotransmitters, the extent to which you do this reuptake pump. Whatever depression is going to turn out to be on this nuts and bolts level, estrogen and progesterone can do something to it. Final class of hormones that are relevant, a class of hormones released during stress. Okay, what's the most famous stress hormone on earth? Adrenaline. Adrenaline is this vastly overrated hormone that I despise because there's a much more important stress hormone out there to which I've devoted the last 30 years of my life. Class of stress hormones called glucocorticoids. They come out of your adrenal gland during stress. The human version is hydrocortisone, also known as cortisol. All sorts of other species out there, you secrete these glucocorticoids when you are stressed. You look at people with major depression, and about half of them have elevated levels of glucocorticoids through the roof. There's something out of whack with the regulation of this stress hormone during depression. What's that about? That's back to people with depression are not invertebrates sitting here in their beds. These are bodies undergoing massive stress responses. There's a huge emotional battle going on, all of it inside their heads. So elevated stress hormone levels. What's very clear is you get exposed to a lot of glucocorticoids and you're more at risk now for depression. You can see this epidemiologically. You get people, and statistically, before their first major depressive episode, something awful, stressful occurs. And that's where this happens, and this is the subset of people who stay down there far longer. Have one of those first depressive episodes due to some stressful event, you come out the other side eventually, you were no more at risk for depression than anybody else. Along comes a second major stressor, and you fall into a depression, come out the other end, no more at risk for anyone than anyone else for depression. Somewhere around the fourth or fifth stress-induced depression, something happens and things start cycling on their own there, and you no longer need a major stressor to cause you to get depressed like that. That's when the clocks are off and running. That's the transition. Okay, so major stress can predispose you towards depression. More evidence, there's a disease called Cushing's disease, where people secrete boatloads of this glucocorticoid stuff. People with Cushing's fall into depressions. There's a whole bunch of diseases where people have to be treated with lots of glucocorticoids. They fall into depression. What are glucocorticoids doing? A whole lot of them, and your brain gets depleted of dopamine. And you're right back in this domain. That's probably neurochemistry, how you get there. Okay, so what do we got at this point? We got something about brain chemistry depression. We got something about the structure of the brain. We got something about hormones. You are a card-carrying biological psychiatrist, and that's all you need to know about the subject. And if that's all you know about the subject, you are going to be pitifully bad at making anybody get better. Because all of this knowledge winds up being effective for treating maybe 30-40% of depressives. The vast majority of people, the antidepressant drugs don't do a whole lot there. All you got there is modern cutting-edge biology stuff, and that's not enough. So what I'll transition to here is now talking about the psychology of depression. Because you better have that piece in the story, or else you're absolutely useless. Starting off with, I make apologies here, but I actually have to say the name of Sigmund Freud here. Because he winds up being very relevant to depression. Freud, back when, dealt with this puzzle of the difference between we all get depressed and come out the other end, and the subset of people who crash. The turn of the century Viennese term for people who come out the other side, mourning. You mourn something and you recover. Turn of the century Viennese term for major depression, melancholia. And Freud in this famous essay said, why is it that a subset of us fall into it? What's the difference between mourning and melancholia? And he came up with a really interesting model. Okay, according to Freud, you have mixed feelings and ambivalencies about everybody you love out there. You love them and you hate them and you resent them and you yearn for them and you reject them and all that Freudian stuff. So in this Freudian view, you have lost a loved one. That can also be a loved concept, a loved goal, a loved thing. You have lost a loved one. What happens then is, in most people, you are able to focus on the love and the sense of loss. You mourn, and you come out the other end. In Freud's view, what melancholia is about is the subset of people who can't put the negative feelings in the background, and instead you are awash in the love and the hate and the regret and the pain and the delight and all of that. And what a depression is this wallowing, this melancholic loss in the ambivalencies you have about the lost loved one. It explains tons. No wonder you have the grief. Lose somebody and go through the mourning business, and only one thing is wrong: you've lost this loved one. Lose somebody with melancholia, and two things have happened. You've lost the loved one, and you have now lost the opportunity to ever make things better with them. No wonder you have the guilt. You're sitting there saying, thank God, I'm finally done with this person. They are never going to control my life. How can I think such a thing like that? Sudden crippling guilt, all sorts of other symptoms. And out of this came this wonderful soundbite: depression is aggression turned inward. Because you've got nobody else out there to have these arguments with. This is the person who you have most loved, but most hated, and you've never said the things you needed to hear, and pounding at the door to get them to finally be able to tell them, and now you've lost that opportunity forever, and all you can do is internalize all of that aggression turned inward. No wonder you're not feeling a whole lot of pleasure. No wonder you're secreting stress hormones. No wonder you're not getting out of bed all that readily with the psychomotor retardation stuff. This really powerful soundbite of aggression turned inward. That's great. What isn't great is, how in hell do you turn like Freudian ambivalent feelings into something about neurochemistry? Or like, what do estrogen progesterone ratios have to do with like love-hate ratios? It's great, it feels very intuitive. You can't do modern science on it, which is the problem with the best parts of Freud. Okay, so instead you need to shift over to looking at experimental psychology and understanding what is the psychology of stress. What is it that makes psychological stressors stressful? And an enormous literature now shows that for the same external misery, you feel more stressed, you turn on a stress response, you're more at risk for stress-related disease if you don't have outlets for the frustration caused by the stressor, if you feel like you have no control over what's happening, you have no predictability as to when it's occurring, and you don't have anybody's shoulder to cry on. This is what psychological stress is about. And what a depression is pathological extremes of this. You fall into the cognitive psychology soundbite of what a depression is. It's learned helplessness. It is learning to be helpless. Something bad happens to you, you a rat, getting some shocks now and then, you a human experiencing some loss, and the logical thing you should do is learn, this is awful. When I'm in this situation, there's not a damn thing I can do about it. It's awful, I feel terrible, but this is not the whole world. And what a major depression is about is you sit there and you're that rat, and in this setting, you get uncontrollable shocks, but put you in another setting, and just by hitting a lever a couple of times, you avoid the shocks, you don't bother doing it because you've learned to be helpless. Just like a human depression. What depression, what learned helplessness is taking a circumstance where by any logic, again, you should be saying, this is awful, but it is not the whole world, and do this cognitive distortion and decide this is indeed the entire world. And I have no control, I am always helpless, I am always hopeless. This is the psychology of what a depression is about. At that point, you don't have a whole lot of trouble seeing how you wind up in here, stress, effects on some of dopamine, all that sort of stuff. Okay, so we've got two extremely different viewpoints here as to what depression is about. Modern biological stuff, and this totally different world of psychology, loss, lack of control. One version of it, one of the most reliable findings in the whole epidemiology of depression is lose a parent to death when you are under 10 years of age, and for the rest of your life, you are more at risk for a major depression. This makes perfect sense. What is a lot of what's going on during your first 10 years of life? You were learning about cause and effect. You were learning about, you're learning, is this a world out there where I have any sort of efficacy, where I have any sort of control? And you have just learned in the most big time awful way, there are things you can't control, and sometimes they are awful. And what have you just learned? There's all sorts of reasons where one can be helpless. And you're that much closer to this edge of this learned helplessness cliff for the rest of your life. Extremely powerful model here of that. So you've got all the biology stuff. You've got this weird Freudian aggression turned inward, which just feels right, but you can't do modern science on it. You've got this whole world. How do you begin to put this world and that world together? And the critical link turns out to be stress. Stress is the intersection of the two. In a very interesting domain. Okay, depression is a genetic disorder. What do I mean by that? Depression has some degree of heritability. Depression tends to run in families. Depression runs more reliably as you look at closer and closer relatives, and you eventually look at identical twins, and if one of them has depression, the other has a 50% chance. Full siblings who are not identical twins, 25% chance, half sibling, about 8%, person off the street, about a 2%, 50% chance when they share the identical genes. What does that do? That tells you this is a disorder that has a genetic component. What does that also tell you? If you've got 50% likelihood, if you've got all the genes in common, and you've got a 50% chance of not getting the depression, it tells you genes are important, but they're not more important than any other component. So genes and depression are not about inevitability, they're about vulnerability. So what is the vulnerability about? A few years ago, people discovered a particular gene that's really relevant to whether or not you get depression. What was exciting about that? It was a very clear finding. It has since been replicated. What else was exciting about it? It made sense. This was not some weirdo gene having something to do with how your big toe functions. This was a gene having something to do with serotonin. And this was a gene relevant to this whole reuptake, pumping business, all of that. The main point of it is this gene comes in two different flavors. Each one of us has one of the two versions. And you immediately get this prediction, one of the versions, by all logic, should be predisposing to depression. One of them is the one that should get you in more trouble. So what does it look like when you go and study it? First paper that reported this a few years ago, and this I suspect is going to wind up being viewed as the most important paper in biological psychiatry for a quarter of a century. This was this massive study where a bunch of researchers looked at 17,000 kids growing up in New Zealand, following them year after year and looking at the genetic makeup of these individuals, and then asking in their early 20s, who's got problems with major depression? And then asking this critical question, what does it have to do with this gene? Does the version of that gene that gets you into trouble, by all logic, is that going to set you up for more of a depression? Are you more at risk for depression if you've got the bad version of the gene? And back comes the finding, which is, no, it doesn't increase your risk. You look here, and what's your likelihood of depression? And you got the good version, and it's likely, and you got the bad version, and it's this likely, doesn't make a difference. Unless something else is going on. Unless you have a history of exposure to major stressors. And what you were able to do is quantify how many major stressors somebody has had during their childhood, their development, and that involves parental divorce and physical abuse and death of family member, all that sort of thing. And what you see is in the folks who have the good version of the gene, as you have more and more of a history of major stressors, your risk of depression goes up, absolutely. Now you look at the people with the bad version of the gene, and as you have more and more of a history of stress, your risk of depression does this. And when you look at the major history of stressors, a 30-fold difference in the likelihood. This is not about, ooh, genes control our brains and genes control our behavior. This is a gene that is relevant to how readily we pick ourselves up after life has dumped us on our rear ends, how readily we recover from stressors. What's the final piece of that story? Glucocorticoids regulate the function of this gene. All the pieces fall into place there. Wonderfully logical, and suddenly you have a way of taking this whole world of psychological components of stress and tying it into all that biochemistry, wonderfully integrated model. Okay, so in lots of ways, this is where the field is at this point. And what should mostly have come through here amid all this minutiae and factoids and all of that is the role of stress and the intersection of biology and the psychological stuff and childhood as a very important time to imprint how vulnerable you are to depression for the rest of your life. But again, the single thing I want to emphasize over and over, implicit in everything on that left side of the board there, which is this is not, oh, pull yourself together, we all get depressed. This is as real of a biological disorder as is diabetes. And that's the thing I most want you guys to take off from here. And in the context of a university setting is rife with major depression. A community of high achieving type A individuals is rife with major depression. It is all around us. And amid it being all around us, there is this weird corrosive inhibition, embarrassment, discomfort we have with the world of psychiatric diseases. One of the greatest things, if you're a researcher with disease, one of the things you pray for is for some powerful senator to have their loved one come down with your disease, because they're going to set up a foundation, get special funding, and advocacy groups, and all of that, not for a psychiatric disorder. That's the one where people don't talk about it. And amid this screaming biology, and this is a devastating disease and all of that, in any place, and especially in a community like this, where everyone is supposed to be golden and functioning and flawless and just gliding through life, this is one of the hardest diseases for people to admit to. So it is there, it's all over the place, and it's biology. And you should be no more inhibited about admitting that you've got something going on that's funny with this type of gene than you would be to admit that your pancreas isn't secreting insulin. So let me stop at this point. And again, unfortunately, I got to sprint out the door. Otherwise, I'm going to take questions. But thanks.
For more, please visit us at stanford.edu.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.